My name's Lois Richter, and this program is called That's Life. And today I have with me Jatan. Now, she is a radio personality. She has a program here on KDRT, just like I do. But she actually came to us having had a radio show way back in Florida. So she's more of a radio personality than I am. So, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time of day it is. Hello, Jatan.
Bonjour, hello, greetings.
So, tell us a little bit about who you are, because our listeners have no idea what we're doing here.
Well, I have a program titled Heart to Heart. I do talk radio, what we used to call talk radio. And I got the name Dr. G because of a fellow who was the director of programs at WFLA in Florida, yes, in Tampa at the time. His name was Dick. And he would walk into the studio, and this was a time when the men would cultivate their voice to be deep and sexy. And he would come in and he'd say, "Hi there, Dr. G." And the name Dr. G ended up being my radio name and my name, my sense of identity, shall we say. And I did hear after I had left WFLA that Dick Norman, who was a very nice man, he wasn't a personal friend, but he was just a very nice fellow and the director of programs, as I said, had stopped after work at one of those 7-Elevens and was hit by some car and died.
Oh.
And he was a man in the middle years of life. He had two children who were school age and a wife. And so for me, Dr. G is always a reminder of Dick Norman. And it's a way, even telling you about that, I feel a bit teary, and I didn't plan that, but he was just a very nice fellow, and I liked the way he'd come into the studio and say, "Hi there, Dr. G." And the name stuck for me. And now, particularly after I heard, and that was a long time ago, that he had died, it's a way of keeping him alive, if you will. It's not, go ahead.
Are you a doctor?
I have a PhD, if that's,
So that makes you a doctor, right?
yes, I know something. I don't know what, but I know something.
Might I ask what you got your PhD in? Because that's a pretty high level accomplishment there.
Yes, I had clinical psychology is what I specialized in because I could see that people could benefit from having some tips and ideas on how to be the better person that they have the makings of being.
Well, I get that that's the psychology part, but what's the political part? You said political psychology.
Not at all. It has nothing to do with politics as I see it. It has to do with when I was young, which is a while ago, I loved philosophy. I wanted to understand how the world works. And then I went to Santa Monica City College. That's how I returned to school. That was back when, a long time ago. And I took some classes in philosophy, of course, but then I also became even more interested in how individuals, and that includes me, of course, how we function. And so I took classes in psychology at Santa Monica City College, where I went for a while, a long time ago.
You're going to be really into that a long time ago stuff, huh? Well, but that makes it more relevant because the classes may not have changed, but the experience of college, I think, has really changed since you and I went to college.
It has changed. I now have grandchildren who are both, two of them of the three are in college at this time, one at the University of Berkeley and one up north, the name escapes me. And the young one in particular, she really wants to understand how things are, how the things function. And I love that about anyone who says, I don't fully understand and I'm interested. I don't claim to know everything and I don't, I just, it's an endless source of learning. And I appreciate that in people. I appreciate that in people of my generation. And I appreciate that about me because I always wondered. I did a lot of reading as a youngster, way back when. But all my reading was in French. I read the philosophers, the playwrights, the people who thought beyond that which is typical of the time, if you will. And that seemed to fit very well with me because I always wondered, and I love the word wonder. Instead of judge, criticize, fault, and tell people how they should be if they only knew what you know. And the fact is, it's so respectful of people when you say, gee, I wonder what the story is there, and I may never know. And even if I know a lot of the story, I've never walked in their shoes. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know how these stories have impacted them unless they tell me something. And even then, I still don't know. And I love that I know that I don't know. So there.
Well, I think when we're children, well, okay, let's start from even earlier than that, we're babies. You have to learn everything. I mean, you have to learn how to move your fingers and toes. You have to learn what they taste like. I mean, it's like everything is new. And then as you're a child, you still are in that situation of there are probably more things you don't know than you do know. You know a few things, but not a lot. And I think what happens is as we get older and we learn more and more and more things, that your personality shines through at that point. Mm-hmm. And there are some persons who get to a point where they go, oh, I know everything now. I can stop wondering about anything. I can stop learning. I'll just do. And then there are other people, and I think both you and I are in this category, who still, even though we know a lot of things, we still wonder about that other thing that's there that I haven't seen that before. Or I wonder how that cloud got that shape, or whatever it is. And so I think that's where our personalities come out.
Well, some of us may have a tendency to be searchers and other and artists, and others have a personality to be something else. But at the same time, it's good at some point to start differentiating, clarifying. What did I learn when I was a youngster, a baby, for example, as you talk about? I'm always fascinated, for example, I love babies. And I'm fascinated with babies. And I noticed that they always learn the language that was spoken at home by their parents, usually, or their caretakers. They may have had the capacity of learning any other language, but they learned what was spoken to them. And for me, it is such a reminder that we are typically like tabula rasa. I don't know how to say that in English.
Tabula rasa.
There you go.
And, what's that mean, anyway?
We learn a lot, but at some point it's good to say, what did I learn? What did I gain wisdom in? Or where do I get my wisdom now? Because a lot of folks will believe everything that's said to them or believe the people they highly respect without ever wondering, has that person done any research that shows that there may be something to this? Mm-hmm. So it's good at some point in life to whether one is young or mid-age or moving on in years, or even incredibly ancient, shall we say, because every period of life brings opportunity to learn more about self and the world and the changes that are taking place. And we both know, I think, that there are so many changes taking place at this moment, and they're happening very fast. And it's good to say, gee, I wonder how all this is impacting me. I wonder what I've learned to believe in, and what do I want to keep, and what do I want to let go of, and what do I want to ameliorate a little bit, maybe. Voila.
So, I want to talk a little about language, if you wouldn't mind. Is that okay?
Language.
Language?
Yeah,
You
I do.
grow up learning French.
I
I
did.
grew up learning English. We are now speaking on a radio show, and we're doing it mostly in English, though you occasionally throw in a few little things. Do
Yes.
you find that? That having read the philosophies in French, that you think about those things in French, or do you now think about everything in English? How does that work? Where do you find the second language coming into play?
Well, I like your question, and my answer is I don't quite know. I wonder about that as well. But
I
I
wonder.
do know that there's value in learning more than one language, and not for business reasons, but for just for shifting how the brain works. Because, for example, being French speaking primarily, I learned a language that speaks more, it is more descriptive, it might be, and it takes time to express something, and it's maybe more artistic, or it may be more asking or wondering. And then I learned English. In fact, as an adolescent, I had a teacher, and I can still remember and think of her, who said, "Gitan, you have to read something in English." And I thought to myself, why would I bother? I'm reading a whole lot and it's wonderful stuff. And so she said, I remember her saying, "Just read anything, read Cinderella, for heaven's sakes." And I thought to myself, how boring does that sound? Although I probably thought of it in French. But I was also working in a library on weekends, and this was a time when people had little cards and you wrote down when the books were due, and that was part of my duties, but also it was my duty to put things back on the shelves. And I came across a book titled, an English-speaking book written in English, titled Paris Underground. And it got my attention because it said Paris, Paris. I've never been to Gay Paris or Paris, and I don't expect that I will go at this moment, but nonetheless, I started. That was the first English book I ever read. And my teacher had difficulty believing that because it was not Cinderella, a very simple kind of book for people who have not read English before. But the story was of two women who smuggled soldiers in the back of their small car. It may have been a Volkswagen, I'm not sure about that. It's a long time ago, I hate to tell you this. But the story was so fascinating that that was the first English book I ever read. And I was an adolescent, and I don't know what age I was, but I was working on weekends in a library, so take it from there.
When you, okay, you said, I'm going to go back to this philosophy thing. You said you read some books in French about philosophy. Later on, you studied philosophy in college. Did you happen to read the same book in English ever? Of a book you've read in French, because what I'm trying to figure out is if the language that you're using changes how you think about what is being said. And you can only know that if you compare, two books, one English, one French, but the same book. Ever happened to you?
It doesn't happen that way. It just happens that I notice how, in comparing English and French, for example, that the description is differently stated or presented in English than it is in French. And oftentimes, a word precedes how it would be said if it was said in French. My thought is simply that there is a benefit in having learned very well a different language because one, the development of the brain is impacted by that. And how exactly? I don't know exactly, but I suspect that there's a difference in the way one thinks. And it's good to, I come back to the word wonder. It's good to wonder about anything and everything and people because no one has had our own experience and we've never had anybody else's experience. And so it's good to take time to listen to a person who's speaking or telling you about something that troubles them or that they loved a lot for that matter, so that instead of saying, "Oh yes, me too," or "I had the same experience as you," or what you should do is, and then the finger of fate comes out, whether it literally comes out, which it might, but it comes out in tone. It's like, "Oh, I know exactly how you should handle that situation." And so
Let
it's,
me fix that for you.
yes, and people sometimes are meaning well, they have very good intention, but sometimes when I've done some presentations, I put my right hand on my left shoulder, and I've said, "This is representing intention. Most people's intention is very good." However, as I slide my hand down my arm and down my fingers and all my out my fingertips and then some, I say, "Just because the intention is good, it doesn't necessarily mean that the delivery was matching the intention." And so it's really good for those of us who are seekers and wanderers and who just don't buy everything that is being said, it's good for us to say, let me wonder about that. Let me wonder how I was impacted as a child, as a baby, as a youngster, as a school-age child. Let me wonder how I was impacted by whoever was teaching me, whoever was present in my life. So that one can determine what is it that was good stuff and I want to keep it. What is it that was maybe based on fallacies of some sort, and so I don't want to keep that, or what do I want to simply rearrange a little bit?
So when today, when you see something that is new, different, you wonder about it. Let's say it's a different kind of flower than you've ever seen before. It's amazing. And look at the structure of that thing. Wow, I didn't know that it would have that many sepals and whatever it is. When you find something like that to wonder about, a physical object, do you just look at it and think about it? Do you write down your observations in a notebook? Do you, I don't know, call somebody up and describe it to them? What form does your wondering take in that sort of a situation?
I think my focus is more on enjoying that moment, whether I see, for example, I take walks in the morning and I walk very slowly at this time. And I love to see the growth and the number of flowers and the number of trees that are blooming. And sometimes I identify them in French and sometimes in English. And something that's very interesting to me is that sometimes if I have been speaking to myself or with somebody else in French, And I turn to English, I have an accent. And I think, but it doesn't last. But it's like I'm still thinking in French. And I notice that and I think, oh, well, that's very interesting. That's it.
Does it work the other way too, if you've been talking English and then you go to speak with someone in French?
I don't know about that. I'll have to explore that. It's more noticeable when I'm speaking French with someone. I love coming across someone who speaks French or they are a little bit versed in the language, and I love to talk with them, respecting their limitations if they're obvious or if they say something about that subject. But I just noticed it more going from French to English rather than from English to French.
And of course, you would notice it more because if you're speaking French to yourself, you can't tell if you have an accent.
Well, if I'm speaking French, I speak a kind of French that is more European in style rather than a patois. And I don't know the word for patois. There's an example of, I know the English word,
Patois.
but there's another word for patois and I don't know what it is.
Dialect, maybe.
I don't know.
I think patois is the is has been incorporated into English because if you were to be talking and say that, people would know what you meant.
Oh, thank you for telling me that. I wonder because I want to be respectful of other people. And just
Sometimes.
like doing a radio program, I have offered at times to do a program in French, and it was thought of as a very good idea. And then it wasn't so good because a lot of people would not understand, and then they would turn this to another station. At least that's what I understood. But I include French words just because I do, because they come. I don't plan on it. It's just that it's natural because I spoke French for lots of years.
I think a lot of the French words which have been incorporated into English have been incorporated in a written form, and most of us English speakers don't know how to pronounce French words. And so I may say a word which I think is French, but doesn't sound anything like what you said.
You're right
That's
on
true
about
in English of lots of languages. You know, there are Spanish words in the language too that they don't sound like what they'd sound like if someone was speaking Spanish. So.
Well, and there are tricks. I say tricks, that's not the right word, but there are tips, if you will, about some letters when they're put together in French. There's a likelihood that they have this sound. And if one learns that, it doesn't guarantee that you will not be in error of some sort and people may not understand you, but it decreases the worry about, oh my gosh, am I saying this correctly? Because if it's two letters, O-N, or AI, they may have a sound in French that would be good to know. And I've got those written down somewhere. I don't know where that somewhere is, but I have that written down because it didn't occur to me that we would talk about that.
Well, there's always things to wonder about.
Well, the thing is that speaking French, sometimes I've had people who've said, "Would you be willing to help me with French? I'm going to Gay Paris for a short while, or my work is sending me there for 3 months, and I'd like to have. I don't want to be fluent in the language, but I want to be able to say a few things, and I love doing that because it helps people's brain development." Anyways, and also it gives them more of a sense of that they fit in more better, shall we say, and that's not French. More better. They fit in because they know a few words, and they may have to say, that's c'est tout, that's all. I can't say anything more, but they've made an effort. And quite often, not always, by the way, but quite often, most of the time, people who are French speaking or so will appreciate the fact that someone's making an effort.
You said you've not been to Paris, but you were going to help someone who was going to Paris to learn a few words in French. Does French have enough different dialects that learning French in Canada is different than learning French in Paris?
Yes, indeed. In fact, I'll tell you a story if I may. I was here where I live, and it was before the pandemic, and I was seated somewhere. It was a Thanksgiving dinner, le jour d'action de grâce in French, by the way. Thanksgiving. And a person I know came to me and said, "You have to meet the person I'm sitting next to you. She's from France." So I said, "Okay." And after a few moments, I walked up and I said, "Bonjour." And the moment she opened her mouth, I knew that she came from the south of France because they speak in a very different way. And it's a language that it's like bubbles. It's very positive and it has a lovely sound. And sure enough, she came from the south of France.
Is that more of an intonation, or is it different words?
I think of it as an intonation, is that things are said differently, with a different focus. Yeah. And she did come from the south of France, and she was a lovely, lovely person. She matched that personality. She had a personality that bounced up and down.
A bubbly person, yeah.
Bubbly, there
So
we go.
where
Yes.
did you learn your French? I know you learned as you were growing up, but where did you grow up?
I was raised in Canada in the province of Ontario. People think, oh, yes, Montreal, Quebec. No. There were many French schools, les écoles françaises, and I went to a French school and we spoke French, and I had friends who spoke French and family who spoke French and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so until a person moved next door and her name was Helen, does that tell you something?
No.
She was English speaking.
And why would her name being Helen tell me that? What would Helen be in French?
Hélène.
Elaine. Oh, okay.
Hélène, H-E, accent aigu. I don't know how to say that in English. Hélène, the second E has an accent grave, and it goes in a different direction, shall we say. And I may have learned a few English words at that time, and I don't know how old I was or she was.
So if Helen becomes Elaine, does it mean that an initial H is suppressed in French?
I don't know that.
Silent? Well, you didn't pronounce Helen with an H. You got rid of the H when you said Elaine.
You're right on about that. Yes, Hélène, the H would be silent, but it's there.
Is that common in French to have that leading
I
H
don't
be
know.
silent?
I'll have to think about that.
Oh well, never mind. It's unimportant. I know that in English, the H is silent sometimes, like honor, but then sometimes it's not, like historical. So English is H is one of those words that can have a before it or an before it. So an honorable award or a historical award.
Whether we're speaking of English or French, there are some things that you just got to know. And what you brought up about Hélène, yes, the H is silent. Henri would be silent also. This is a man's name, Henri.
Oh, we
Henri.
would say Henry, right?
Yes, in English it would be Henry with an H, ha. And in French it would be Henri. And you can ask me a question about that, but I don't know the answer.
That's okay. You know the language. You know how to pronounce it, whether you know if there's a rule about that or not. It's like, I don't know if there's a rule about when the H is silent and when it's not in English, historical and honor, but I know how to pronounce things.
I do know that I learned la grammaire française, grammar in French, but I hate to tell you this, and this may shock you, of course. This was a heck of a whole long time ago.
Oh, yes, I understand. We
And so
both
I
learn
don't
things
know, but
as.
I never learned the English grammar, but I read a lot in English.
You learned the English grammar to use rather than learning the rules.
Yes.
And that's the way most people learn their language is, I guess studying English in grammar school is the first and only time that I've ever, what do they call it, graphed a sentence. So, and here's the noun for the front, and here's the verb, here's the adjectives, and these things are, and it's like, I've never used that since I was a child.
Of course,
Of
of
course.
course.
But I can tell the difference between an adverb and an adjective in use. That's really all that's important to me.
Well, bravo.
Bravo or brava.
That too.
Yeah, that's the other thing about French and Spanish and German is they have genders in their words. And it's like, what? A cat's a cat. This is not a male cat or a female cat. But if you go to some other language, then cat is a female word or a male word or whatever. It's like, how can a sofa be male? That doesn't make sense. So
In
I have
French, a male cat would be un chat, and a female cat would be une chatte.
Yes, but if you're just talking about the cat walk down the street, is the male or female?
It depends if one knows the cat.
Doesn't know the cat.
One may choose one or the other, which, however, the thinking mind works.
Oh,
Looks like a
that's
female
interesting.
cat to me, so la chatte vient par ici, vient, je la vois, I see her.
And if
Even
I say el gato, which is the Spanish, it's going to be an el gato. It's a masculine, the. Anyway, we are getting so distracted. We have to come right back and zoom on into Jatan's experiences as a radio personality, since that's how I introduced you.
Thank you. And I love radio. There's something about a radio station that I remember being, I forget somewhere, but it's by the ocean here in Northern California, and walked by a radio station and I was eager to go in. I didn't have a lot to say. I just liked the flavor of a radio station. And there's something about that. And I was first introduced to radio, maybe not the first time, but the one time that I'm going to talk about is that I was a psychotherapist at that time. And Paul Gonzalez invited me as a guest on his program. He had, if I remember correctly, a 2-hour program from maybe 2 to 4, something like that, 5 days a week. And I liked Paul Gonzalez. He was a very nice fellow. And he invited me as a guest for the first hour. And it was a fit. It was like, oh, yes, I like this. I intuitively felt at ease. And when he said, can you stay for the second hour? And I said, well, I thought you had a guest maybe. Oh, that can be rearranged. Okay. I learned to say yes to things that I didn't know quite what was expected of me, but it's like, I can do that. And eventually the program director said to me, we'd like you to have your own program. And I said,
yes.
Yes. Okay. Whatever. And at that time it was a call-in program and it was much easier because, and I think it had much more merit perhaps, in that I never knew what somebody was going to bring up. At the top of the hour, I may have talked about sibling rivalry. And then there's a call and the last thing they want to talk about is sibling rivalry. And I can switch like that. It's fine by me. I really enjoy it.
This must have been a very large city because I can't imagine, you know, like in Davis, you would get maybe one call a month.
If that, because if you ask for opinions, people are willing to give their opinion. But if you ask, you know, if something is bothering you or troubling you or you'd like to learn about that has to do with yourself, feel free to call in a small town like Davis. They will not call in. It's just not going to happen.
Well, it's because you want to keep your private stuff private because everybody knows everybody. Yeah. So how big a town was that where you were doing your calling?
Well, it was St. Petersburg, Tampa. So it was a very large.
Huge.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And in those days, we had an engineer on the other side of the glass. And frequently there was a fellow in particular, I had something in my ear and my left ear, and he'd talk to me and he'd say, oh, Dr. G, that was brilliant. It didn't make me think, oh, I must have been particularly brilliant that time. It's that it was, we were doing the program together. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't matter what he said to me. It was like I wasn't alone in the radio station doing a program. I loved it. And of course, the person on the engineer, would take care of taking calls, mm-hmm. and then they'd put them on the monitor.
And having that interaction, having that feedback in your ear, it made it almost like having an audience. And it's much different to produce something where there is, you know, there's someone listening. When I was doing my radio show and I'd go into the station and I'd be there all by myself and there'd be nobody around and I'd do my thing and I have no idea if anybody's listening to anything.
Yes.
It's a different experience. Whereas before that, when I would do the television shows, we had a crew. And so there was a group of us that got together every week and did this thing. Actually, it was, our crew was more interactive than usual. I would call it a repertoire crew, so that at some point I would say, Charlotte, do you want to come and be on stage for a while? Oh, sure. And she'd leave the camera to somebody else and come down and we chat or whatever. But they were also the audience. I could see their faces and I could feel the reaction of the person to what was happening on stage. And that is so wonderful.
It is a factor that is in many instances missing nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody was telling me about a well-known TV person, and I don't remember who it is, so I can't, even if I wanted to, I can't give you his name. But it was a person of the male variety who had a program, and then came the pandemic, and now he was doing the program in the TV station, but he was by himself. Nobody was there. And as I understand, or as I was told, he was not funny at all. And then, of course, the audience was reinvited, and all of a sudden, he was blooming again. There's something about the interaction, even if it's limited, and even if it's not focused, there's something about that that is a fuel for one's own spirit. And it requires a great deal of capability to do a program by oneself when there's no audience, nobody in the studio, nobody against on the other side of the glass. And it requires a great deal because the aliveness has to be self-produced.
Yes, exactly. And one of the reasons that I really enjoy doing the radio shows now, well, since the pandemic, when the station was closed, we had to do things at home. And so I got used to doing this Zoom call. So, listeners, right now I'm looking at that computer screen and I see Jetan's face. I can see her expression. I can see when she's smiling. If she were ever to frown, I'd see that too. But the fact that we can interact with a face included makes it a much easier way to do a show. Now, I have done shows where it was just me, but I can just sit here and read something off a magazine and it sounds really boring. But the ones that did work well when I didn't have someone to interview was when I was doing music. So I'd pull out a song and I'd play the song, and then I'd talk about the song. And I was not interacting with a human being, but I was being stimulated by that song. And then I had something to say. Whereas doing an interview on the phone only is really tough, really tough.
It is, and in fact, on my program, I used to have maybe once a month or so a guest, and I always had guests who could come into the studio. And I'd say to them, I don't do interviews, but we will have a conversation. And some of them were nervous because it's media and they had not done that. But how many times did we reach, near the end of the hour, and somebody said, oh my gosh, it's just like we were talking with each other.
And
And I
we
say,
were.
that's exactly what we did. I give them the floor. But since more recently, I've had, at this moment, I'm not doing guests, but I will eventually, maybe. I did one guest in January with David Trolley, and we did it by phone. And I know David Trolley, and he's a very creative musician, and he has a lot to offer. And so I came already knowing his work. Yet at the same time, he was at the end of a phone line. In March, I had Craig Dressong, and I said to Craig is the director of YOLO Hospice, which is now called YOLO Cares. And he's been on my program three times before the pandemic. And so I said to him, nowadays we do things a little bit differently, so I can give you a call. Or because I know the kind of work that you do, and I trust that you are safe, a safe person, if you'd like to come to the studio, that would be fine with me. But I didn't want to put any pressure of preference. And he immediately said, I'll come to the studio. And I was happy. And he came to the studio. It was in March, and he was his brilliant self. And we had again a conversation. And when I have guests again, they will be for the most part by phone, and yet we will have a conversation.
And one can always do it on Zoom.
Well, you're very good at doing that, but I'm
I've seen a couple of your presentations on Zoom and you did fine.
Oh, on a presentation, yes. In fact, fairly recently, I made my office have a little more space, which means I have more messes everywhere in the house. Shh, I didn't say that. Never mind. But I did a presentation that required movement. I was teaching one of the local churches, in fact. I was teaching a movement form that is called Phoenix Rising or the Rising Phoenix. So there's movement that goes with that. So I needed more space. And I may do that again, and yet I have to tell you that there's a difference that is significant. It's not just a difference, it's a difference that has a different impact when it's done by phone or when it's done by, because one is present and the other people are present. And I know that this is the day and time of, doing things remote, and we need to find out how to do that best and better. Good, better, best. Never let it rest till your good is better and your better best. Was one of my teachers that said that. She was English speaking, and she had that saying, good, better, best, never let it rest till your good is better and your better best. And
Well, that's a great way to learn good, better.
yes, it is. And it was said in English. Well, the thing is that what I like about that saying is that it can be interpreted as what do other people want? What does the system want? And that's not necessarily terribly helpful. But it can be taken, how can I be my best self? Not perfect, by the way, but an open-minded self, a heart self. Oh, heart to heart, no kidding. It's not an accident that the name of my program is Heart to Heart. It's about talking about feelings, not, what do you think about this? There's value in that as well, but it's not the only thing. One needs to put one's hand on one's heart and say, how do I feel about this? And then what it's called the first dantian, just below the belly button, that's a sense of intuition. Oh my gosh. And it's important to differentiate between one's opinion and one's deeper truth. That is the challenge.
I am going to be challenged to understand what you're talking about.
Yes, well, I may
Sounds
have
like I need to listen to your show,
Well, in doing the program, I learned a long time ago. For a while, I had a transcontinental or across the states program, and I never knew. And if somebody, I was in Florida at that time, and if someone called from Northern California, I could tell because they had a certain measure of sophistication and self-knowledge. They'd been in therapy. And then I'd be we followed by somebody who came from some other location in the states. And they didn't have that same sophistication. They said, I remember one fellow who said, oh, I have so many problems, I don't know where to start. And I said, well, let's take a look at that. Let's put them in some kind of order. Because, and it's not a judgment about one being better, it's just that one hopefully learns to be more in tune with one's thought, one's heart and one's intuition, and knows the difference between intuition and opinion. And that's the very difficult thing to learn because we have learned the opinions of our parents or our teachers, or and if we've never questioned, then we've say, well, this is the way it is. I know that. I am sure of that. Well, have you ever wondered about it?
We're back to wonder, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
I think everything comes back to wonder eventually.
Yes, it does. And wondering from the heart as well is like, how do I feel? Does it feel right with me? Well, no, but it's the way it is. Well, then, you know, let's take a look, a closer look at what's going on for you. How come your heart says no, even though your head says yes?
Mm-hmm.
And good health, mental, full body being help. Health is when the thinking mind, the feeling mind, and the intuitive mind are in accord and are working together very well. And all of us tend to have a particular specialty, or that's not the right word, but we tend to be thinkers, or we tend to be feelers, or we tend to be intuitive. But the fact is, we need to develop all three of those capabilities, even though we may always be best at one of them. That may be our tendency, and that's fine. I am so glad that the world is made up of people who differ from each other. Think of how boring it would be if everybody was the same. My Lord.
And confusing.
Yes.
I mean, if someone leads with their head and another leads with their heart, and they're both friends of yours, well, you have expectations of what the one or the other is going to interact with you. Mm-hmm. And if everybody were the same, you would be missing out on 2/3 of your own capability. Because when I'm with a friend who's leads with her heart, well, my heart gets energized.
And a simple way that I put it in is, thank goodness somebody knows how to do my taxes, because the last thing I want to do is call myself a tax specialist. Anybody who would hire me would be in trouble. And yet I like the fellow who does my taxes is kind, caring, and delightful. Yet at the same time, he understands numbers. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that he has that difference about him, because if I said, you know, I could make more money if I was into real estate, for example, it's like, I don't feel like being in real estate. It's just not,
not
it's
good.
Not me expressing that in me that is in accord with my truth, shall we say.
So I think we're getting close to the end of the hour.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to expand our discussion a little bit and talk about how individuals can or cannot expand their wonderness, their awesomeness, their I'm not even sure how I'm going to phrase this. I exist. I've got my life. My life has a pattern, a habit, a steadiness to it. And unless something dramatic or drastic happens to me, well, I'll probably continue pretty much in those patterns. Is there a benefit or a disadvantage to trying to expand what you're doing in your life?
It seems like there's more benefit than there could be some harm in doing that. I don't see that. It seems like there would be value in saying, for example, something that I ask people to think about is, when you were a child, did you have some interest that didn't get a chance to be pursued? Either it didn't fit monetarily, or didn't fit in your parents' perspective, or whatever it is. Because is that something that you would like to pursue at this time? Is this a part of yourself? And maybe you cannot be, for example, one person said, I always wanted to be an opera singer. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the person was of some age, and it wasn't going to happen, but she found herself getting involved with an opera company. And she was one happy camper, because she was in a field that was related to something that had been appealing to her as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Without the question being, yes, but how much money are you going to make with that?
It sounds like a perfect discussion to have at the time that you retire, if you've been working outside the home and then suddenly you're not in that office anymore and you have opportunities. And that sounds like the perfect time. But there are a lot of people who don't work outside the home, and their retirement doesn't really happen. I mean, it happens if their partner retires and is suddenly around all the time, but making those kinds of life changes,
Yes.
it sounds like a good thing to think about, to consider.
Yes, to consider and then to wonder how is that fitting in my life at this moment? Maybe it doesn't fit at all. Maybe it fits, but in a very indirect kind of way. It's just about knowing oneself and honoring oneself more thoroughly, shall we say. And retirement or moving on in years is a good time to do that because it's a time of considering who is this me that I claim to be, and is there a part of me that I'd like to give rebirth to or that I'd like to expand upon? And sometimes people say, "Why can't they make any money with that?" Well, maybe you could volunteer, for example. But and maybe that doesn't fit either, but it's good to know oneself more thoroughly and know what parts of self were denied or not given an opportunity to blossom.
I am a good
When
believer.
I walk, I see flowers and I think there are so many flowers, so many different kinds. And even though I'm not a birder per se, I get a magazine about birds, and oh my gosh, I learned so much about the differences in birds and their particular perspective and the way they do things and the places they go. It's absolutely fascinating. So it's in that same verve, if you will. Can one be fascinated with oneself and say, what if there are parts of me that never were given a chance or didn't fit into the world as it was back then? And maybe I want to give rebirth to it or expand on it at this time.
Thank you, listeners, for joining us today. This is Lois Richter. The program is That's Life, and we have been talking to Jatan. So, Jatan, thank you for coming and joining us. I was really pleased to have you here.
Merci bien. It was a pleasure for me as well. And I will simply say au revoir.
Au revoir.